Hello and welcome back to the New Englanders with Sarah and Connor. It's been a while since you last heard from us, but we are so glad to be back, and you can expect to see us getting back to regular episodes.
We're very happy to be back. We've got a few news stories for you today. Later on, we're going to be interviewing our good friend Luke Wanpound, who we both know from college. He's a musician who just put out some music, and he's from Maine. That will be coming later, but first up, we've got some news.
New news with the New Englanders.
Okay, so I have a news story out of Rhode Island today, specifically out of Burrillville, Rhode Island, which is where the Conjuring House is located. Back in 2022, a woman named Jacqueline Nunez purchased the house. It was previously owned by a couple who had owned it for only like 3 years or so. And then prior to that, I think had been under one owner for a long time. And if you don't know, the Conjuring House is a super famous haunted house that inspired a movie. They had Ed and Lorraine Warren go there and do their whole shtick of trying to, like, I don't know, get rid of the spirits or whatever. I don't even remember. I don't even know if I've watched The Conjuring.
What?
I don't remember if I've seen it or not. I think that I did.
That's like,
I know that's an insane thing to say, as somebody who loves horror movies, but
I was gonna say that's like a require. I don't even like the movie that much, but I feel like you have to have seen it.
I think I probably saw it like around when it came out, but that was a while ago at this point. But anyway, the house is a tourist attraction. So I actually looked into this recently because I was camping near there. And you can basically pay to like sleep there or like pay for like regular tours and stuff like that. But to sleep over there, it costs like a lot of money. It is from Sunday to Thursday, it's $960 a night for a party of six.
For camping there?
No, you like sleep on the floor inside of the house.
Oh, what?
Yeah. And then on Friday and Saturday, it's $1,280 a night for a party of eight people. And then it's $160 a person for additional guests.
Okay. I mean, I guess when you average it out, it's like just a hotel.
I guess, but it's like you have to bring your own sleeping bag and like sleep on the floor.
I mean, that's kind of, to me, that's more fun, you know,
yeah, but
sleepover style.
That's so expensive. Okay, so if you were paying $960 and you have six people, yeah, it's $160 a night per person.
Yeah.
That's more expensive than like an Airbnb should, like, or, you know, I guess it's like the experience of like the haunted house, but like, I'm not going to pay $160 to go to any haunted house.
But this is like the most famous haunted house.
Whatever. I don't know.
I guess I see why someone would do it. I agree that I don't think I'm shelling out. But I'm also scared that, like, ghouls would get me.
That's fair. I mean, I think that I would definitely be, like, stressed in there. Like, I don't think that I would ever do this, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, it was funny because when I was looking into this, I looked at their, like, rules and regulations page, which is just a lot of things to, like, cover their ass in case something happens. But...
I feel like that's good, things... like, world building, you know, to, like, make you sign a waiver, like, in case, like, a ghost, like,
oh, sure.
Does,
for sure.
Like... physically attack you, like that would make me feel like even more sure I was gonna get physically attacked by a ghost.
Yeah, here's some of their lists of things that I just, this list of, I don't know, their rules. No alcoholic beverages allowed, that's fine. No recreational drugs allowed, fine. Do not touch any cameras, sure. Do not tape down wires to anything, okay.
What
do not provoke, so like if you have like ghost hunting equipment, like cameras and stuff, they don't want you to like tape the like,
okay.
Yeah. Do not provoke, ridicule, challenge, or disrespect the spirits. No seances or crossing over of spirits allowed. This one made me laugh because, so you always have to think about like, rules are usually put in place because someone tried to do something and then you realize we don't want people doing that here. So one of them is no sexual activity or making out allowed. Which I just have to laugh at, as somebody like probably tried to, whoa, fuck in the Conjuring House.
Wait a minute. What are the typical group sizes? Did you say it's like usually 8 people in there?
Well, it's you can pay the money and it's up to 6 people allowed or up to 8 people allowed.
Okay.
But you could go with just 2 people.
Okay, but you can like pay for the house as like one party.
Like, yes.
Okay, you're not like you're never expected to like stay in the Conjuring house with strangers.
I don't think so. No, no.
That's still insane. I mean, I guess they did say something about like don't screw with the cameras. Are there cameras just like
sort of? So there's definitely like security cameras in there. Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if they also have like some sort of weird like ghost monitoring that they're trying to do there or something.
Well, for sure. And I mean, they like encourage people to bring their own like stuff.
Yeah. That's a crazy rule though, especially as like something that's
no making out. Like you can't even like that's the funnier one to me. It's like I get like you can't have sex here, but you also can't make out. Like that's out of bounds.
It's gonna make the ghosts mad.
Yeah. The ghosts are gonna get horny.
Jesus Christ.
And then they also have don't steal anything. This one's funny. It's like do not steal anything from the interior or exterior. Trust us on this. It's like
well, because you're going to bring the ghost home.
Right, exactly. But it's also like, you could just say, don't steal anything. Like, that's a normal rule of any place.
I was going to say, that doesn't even need to be stipulated as as a specific rule. Like, stealing
like theft
is
illegal. So, yeah. Yeah. They also have, don't use the fireplace. Do not light any candles. Mm. Obviously, they don't want fires to happen. Do not get under the bedding. Sleep or sit on the top sheets only. Do not put your shoes or boots on the beds. Place your trash in the receptacles before you leave. Shut exterior doors behind you when you go outside. No digging or use of a metal detector, which I think is weird. The metal detector one anyway. Notify staff if you get locked out. The ghosts don't need keys. And then they say they don't allow drones. And then it says, don't be the reason we add another rule. They have the waiver on here too, which has a huge thing about the assumption of risk. The farm in itself is unique and has been known to cause fear and anxiety for our attendees. And they're saying that they assume the risk of weak floorboards, uneven floorboards, broken floorboards, Jesus, obstacles and obstructions in rooms and hallways, complete darkness, dimly lit stairs, steep inclined stairs, sudden motion or movement of objects, loss of time / sense of space, loud noises that may impair or cause loss of hearing. Jesus.
What?
Violent spiritual attacks, electrical shock, bright lights, spirit attachments, equipment failure or loss, objects, spirits, or other people falling on or striking you. Any acts by you or others due to fear, anxiety, dizziness, asthma, impaired vision, and any other emotional, physical, or psychological condition. The failure of any safety device or procedure, frightening statements and or conduct. What? Yeah, so this goes on. Friction burns, other abrasions. Oh my God. They also say holes in the ground, uneven surfaces, dead branches and or trees. So they're just like anything that happens, it's your fault. You also agree to being filmed and used for ads, TV commercials, website content, posters, evidence in a court of law, and any other reason.
See, that's weird to me. It does seem like they're like filming the interior for the entire time you're there.
Yep. That's so it's anything that you do or say is like filmed and can be used for anything.
Hence, no making out.
Hence, no making out. Yeah. They also
they have like
special
a,
rates
like a
for
speaker in there like hey stop it.
they have special rates for if you're like an influencer too and stuff like that.
I feel like I've seen like an influencer like I've probably seen like a YouTube thumbnail of like some B-tier influencer like staying there in the past
for sure. Yeah, here,
let me look this up. Well, what's it called?
The Conjuring House.
Duh. Let's see. Okay, tons of people do this.
Yeah, because it's the most famous one.
Well, I mean just like tons of people stay here for YouTube.
Oh, of course. I mean, it's a great content creation thing. And on our website, it says, are you a social media influencer, YouTube, or another type of content creator? If so, do you have under 15,000 followers / subscribers?
That's funny.
Yeah.
There, wait, What do you,
you
think
must
they
notify
do?
Us like, wait, why do they have different,
is there a clout discount?
Yeah, they, I think they have a clout discount.
That's insane. So it looks like the main like YouTubers that have like made content here are some pair of influencers named Sam and Colby that I've never heard of, but mm-hmm. they have like an entire series of videos that are like an hour each minimum, and they have like millions of views, like 24 million views
wow.
on the first one. And it's them saying surviving a week at the real Conjuring house. It's funny because these videos came out like 10 months ago, but I swear these people look like they're just straight out of the year like 2010. Like there's something about them. They look like, and I don't mean that like they're millennials. I mean, they look like probably pretty young, like 20s, but they just look like the type of people that existed in like,
oh,
the
I see exactly what you mean. I know. I completely, they look British. Are they British?
Derogatory.
Derogatory.
I don't know. They're just like the tank tops and like the like bowl
the
cuts.
Hair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This looks like I don't know. There's something uncanny about their appearance.
I love like these like bad YouTube thumbnails.
I know. But there's also something funny about their like also like they just don't look like right for being there. Like the Conjuring House does look very era appropriate, like it looks straight out of the 1700s, 1800s, and there's something about the like smosh aesthetic just dropped into it. It just doesn't look right.
On their website, they have a social media influencers and YouTubers like thing that you have to sign, like a waiver for social media, and it says that if they violate it, they are subject to a fine of $1,000 per day of violations. And they have to remove all the content from all social media. They have to send all videos, promos, and teasers to the people at the Conjuring House for approval at least 72 hours before posting on any social media or streaming platform.
Odd.
And their rules are no provoking, taunting, ridiculing the spirits, no crossing over of spirits, no casting spells, no seances, no inviting of any attachments, no fabrication or falsification of any evidence or history whatsoever. No stealing objects, no perpetuation of falsities that we know are untrue. Whoa, see the attached historical narrative for reference. You are responsible for relaying the history as currently known. No drones, no pre-recorded live stream. Yeah. I mean, it's like valid, but it's like them basically being like, you can't lie for views about what happens to you, which I think is fine.
Yeah.
I just find it funny that they're like, you have to send us like... the video for approval first.
Yeah, that's odd. And what's the fine otherwise?
$1,000 per day of violations. So, like, I guess if the video stays up for 4 days, it would be $4,000.
The legal situation surrounding this house is bizarre to me. Like, the way
none of this
that
is
this
even
is
like
written.
What I am gonna be. This isn't even like my news article.
Oh, what's
this? Is just me talking about the Conjuring
the
House.
Of- Okay, so we've just been establishing context this whole time.
So the reason I know any of that is because I looked into it to, like, potentially go.
Okay.
And then I was like, okay, no, fuck this. This is stupid. So that's why I know all of that.
Okay, okay.
Today, when I was looking for a news article, I saw one about the Conjuring House, and so I clicked on it, and it's like, the woman who owns it is an insane person. So she just bought the house in 2022.
Oh, okay, new owner.
Yeah, and so as of July, she's been getting complaints from former employees that she has, like, stolen money from them, or, like, owes them a bunch of money and has, like, harassed them.
Wow.
And so she told the Providence Journal that former employees had stolen money from her. Since all of this, she has been committed to hospital psychiatric wards twice, claiming that it's the former employees that forced her in there so that they can, like, take over the house. And she keeps contacting, like, the newspapers and the press and, like, telling them weird shit. But anyway, for context of what the employees are saying... So a former employee in July filed a complaint with the State Department of Labor and Training alleging that Nunez, the owner, had improperly withheld about $9,000 in pay from him.
Wow.
In August, he filed a superior court lawsuit alleging similar facts and seeking payment of the $9,000 plus additional damages totaling $21,000. In the suit, he said that Nunez fired him on July 19th after telling him in a text that John Arnold, a previous owner of the house, had told her that he stole more than $3,000 from the business. She said, "John Arnold told me you've been stealing, and I want you to pay my money back, and I want you to leave." John Arnold died in 1839.
Whoa. Okay. So the ghosts are involved in what seems right. like a more petty dispute.
Right. So Nunez, the owner of the house, who also owns a Boston-based real estate firm, which is probably how she has all these like legal things like perfectly set up, said she is a medium and a channel and has been informed of other matters that are untoward from previous staff and even mischievous guests. From the spirits, I guess. She said, Arnold also said that he has told me many things since I brought the property and the business in May of 2022. Don't expletive with me or I'll expletive with you. That's what the article said. You are a liar, Brian. And Brian was the employee who tried to claim that she withheld pay from him.
Wow.
Additionally, in addition to just this guy, seven other former employees and people with ties to the property released a statement on social media declaring that they were no longer affiliated with the house, citing that their experiences within that work environment were negative. Then, after all of this, in August, Jason Hawes, who starred in the Ghost Hunters TV show, who like lives in the area, filed a complaint with police in West Greenwich, which I think is a town near there, saying that Nunez had been harassing him after she said online that he'd been trespassing at the house. She said she had video footage from the house of a truck leaving and the driver supposedly looks like him. He was able to prove that it was not him through like social media and fans, and somebody ended up commenting saying that it was them. Whatever. It wasn't him, I guess. But then she texted him saying, alleging that he, quote unquote, knew of the assassination attempt on me and also accused him of abuse, sexual abuse, and rape.
What?
Like, there's like no deeper context to this. I guess that he's obviously been to the house before because he's a Ghost Hunters guy. So like they've acquainted probably and he's probably been there and interacted with her. But seemingly she's like throwing out all these like crazy claims about him attempting to kill her and stuff. Apparently, though, where it gets interesting... Well, I guess it's already interesting. Where it gets a little bit more interesting is that his daughter and her fiance both worked at the house for like multiple years and they were starting some sort of like TV show or something like that, also to do with paranormal stuff. And they were storing all of their equipment, including like cameras and like all that stuff, as well as items that supposedly had some sort of paranormal something or other to do with them, stored in a barn on the property that last year, quote-unquote, accidentally caught on fire and all of their stuff was destroyed. So it was like over $8,000 worth of stuff. And Nunez was supposed to pay them back the damages and has not yet.
Messy. Messy at the Conjuring House.
So like, yeah. So I feel like she's like trying to be like, oh, well, now the dad is like threatening me and like all this. Like, I feel like it's just become super messy.
Yeah.
And as of the article that I was reading, which came out like, I think a week ago or something like that, she was still like in a psychiatric ward and not like with no plans to release yet. I don't know if she's gotten released since then. And then after all of this, comedian Matt Rife offered to buy the house.
Matt Rife?
Because he was just like, he was like, oh, like I'll handle all of your like financial whatever and like pay people out.
What the hell does he have to do with any of this?
And she said, it is not for sale. I'm never selling the Conjuring House. I'm never selling the property. Never. That's what she replied with when he offered to buy it.
I feel like no matter what happens, when her life has ended, she will also be one of the ghosts.
Oh, totally. 100%.
She will eventually be haunting this house along with everyone else.
I'm really interested like to know the previous owners had only owned it for like 3 years. Like they bought it in 2019 and sold it in 2022. Obviously COVID probably fucked them like financially, so that might be why they sold it. But apparently one of the conditions of the sale was whoever bought it could not live in the house year round. Like the couple who sold it to her basically made her agree to only stay in the house 1 week per month after they said the stress of living in what many regard as the most haunted house in America could be unhealthy. So I wonder if she's just been like living there full time or like spending too much time in there and now has like gone totally insane and is obviously like in a psychiatric ward somewhere right now.
I mean, I imagine the stress is, I mean, it's not only just the spiritual stress, but then also like the financial like situation.
Oh yeah.
I do think like the funniest part about this to me is that these eight spirits from like the 1800s who seem to spend most of their time just like banging on the walls and like throwing books around and stuff, mm-hmm. and then like causing people like spiritual like trauma. With her, they're just kind of like, hey, like, listen, I saw your employee kind of like sneaking some money out the register. Like, with her, they're very like,
like literally from the gift shop. Like she was like, oh, he's stealing money from the gift shop.
The spirits with her are just very like coworkerly. With everyone else, they're like ghouls.
It's just, I don't know. It's sad because the guy who got fired, who like she withheld $9,000 from, was like an older guy, and he was planning to have that be like his final career, like his final job or whatever. And so he got like wrongly fired, and I read somewhere that he like started a GoFundMe to like raise money to survive because he was wrongly fired and hasn't been getting paid, and like, yeah, it's insane.
Well, I hope that they can resolve some of these.
I know. I mean, I hope that this guy gets like his money, and I hope that the couple who had all of their stuff like burned down gets their money.
I mean, Matt Rife is trying to make it right for some reason.
For some reason. I mean, because he thinks that it's funny, probably, which it's like, and also if he bought it, that would be so bad. I feel like
I could definitely see it not going well. But also, like, what is Matt Rife's particular interest in the Conjuring house? Like, what could he possibly get out of this?
Yeah, I think that he saw, because I think that there was like some social media back and forth because obviously influencers film stuff there.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure that it's like valuable for that exact reason that like.
Yeah, I feel like that's how probably a lot of this started becoming like kind of seen.
I could see within like the next couple years, there's going to be the like, what's her name? Like Kai Cenat and then the Speed. Like they're going to be like live streaming from the Conjuring house 24/7.
Yeah, honestly.
That doesn't strike me as something that
I mean, she said in the social media waiver, it says live streaming is not allowed.
Okay. Okay.
Or like you can live stream for a maximum of like 1 hour or something weird like that. Like you can't do like a full night.
I honestly think that's like a good thing. I don't really know what the like actual like historic value of the house is beyond like the way that like it's portrayed in media and like the way that it's like considered amongst people interested in like the paranormal and supernatural. But mm-hmm. It does strike me as like you wouldn't want to see it become purely rambunctious teenage behavior like 24/7 and people making ridiculous videos there.
Right.
That might already be what's going on. Like, I haven't seen... I was just saying that there are, like, a bunch of videos there, and who knows?
Yeah.
Part of me is, like, it's maybe good that they have a screening process for the media that comes
out. I mean, she put
in
it, too. If you just include a statement in the video that says something like, the contents of this video aren't based on evidence or facts, like, you can kind of do what you want. You just have to, like, have a disclaimer somewhere about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like... people probably get away with like lying about stuff as long as there's like some disclaimer at the beginning or the end that no one ever like
yeah
thinks is legit.
I guess this is all because they're really concerned because they have a couple videos out. Like the Conjuring House YouTube page has a bunch of videos that they are like claiming this is like actually real supernatural activity, and they want to make sure that those videos aren't getting like devalued by the random, you know, YouTubers like just making a mess. But that's kind of funny that like I think it's all just to do with their foundation for the videos that they're like these are 100% real is strong.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. I'm reading the article that got put out 2 years ago when she bought it, and just like the way she talks is even different than it is now. I think that she's just gone kind of crazy.
That's what spending all your time with ghoulies will do.
Yeah.
You know, the spiritual attacks,
oh my gosh.
What?
They close on the house for $1.525 million.
Like in the 2022 sale?
Yeah.
That completely makes sense to me.
Oh, it's also 8.5 acres of land.
Yeah. It's like 8.5.
I did not know it was that big.
Acres of land in Rhode Island.
And also famous house.
Exactly. And they're making like what? Like a minimum of a couple hundred a night. Like, did they say it's like up to eight people and that'd be like $1,100 or something?
Well, for one night you would get $1,200.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, as an investment property, like, totally makes sense.
For sure. Yeah. But she's like straight up just like, she was just a real estate person.
Yep.
Who bought it and wanted to turn it into
a
business.
And a spiritual medium and psychic.
Apparently, which is does not get mentioned in this article.
Maybe those are more recent discoveries.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. She does say she does not plan on being alone there. This was in 2022.
Mm.
She spends a lot of daytime hours there. I expect some paranormal phenomena to happen to me, she said. I expect to be startled. I expect to be scared that I'm experiencing something, but I don't expect a malevolent experience.
Oh my God. This is kind of like sad to look back and someone say that. And then like 2 years later, they're like, the ghosts are talking to me regularly about the petty theft that happens in my business on a daily basis. Like, man.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Like things really went downhill from there.
So yeah, that's my news story, my big news story today.
Well, let's hope that they can resolve some of the like modern day issues surrounding the issues and drama surrounding the Conjuring House.
I sure hope so.
All right. So we can fly up now to Worcester, Vermont, where theft of a different type has rocked a local community. So a local family for years have had a T-Rex statue that sits at the front of their property, right at the corner. And this little T-Rex, it's not very big. It's like 5 feet long, a couple feet high, most likely with some sort of piece of like playground equipment or like amusement park equipment. This little T-Rex has been like a local fixture as far as people use it as a landmark. It's beloved in this small community that lives around it. And it has disappeared.
Oh my God.
A couple weeks ago, the T-Rex up and vanished. The family had the T-Rex there for over 2 decades.
Oh my God.
Yeah, like, or for 2 decades, so roughly 20 years.
That's crazy. I was expecting you to be like, for like a couple
years.
Yeah,
no, they're distraught. People have grown up around it, and it just disappeared.
How big did you say it was?
It's like 5 feet long and probably, I mean, from the picture, it looks like 3 feet high-ish. We'll include a picture on Instagram if anyone wants to take a look. If anyone's seen this T-Rex, then please like report to us or the authorities or someone.
Report it to the authorities. Do not report that
to
us.
No, give us the scoop. We'll be the first to, drop the news.
We'll be on site.
Yeah, if you want to give us the scoop, I mean, we'll obviously alert the authorities, but tell us first. And anyways, the family who owned the T-Rex went on a vacation, and then they returned from the vacation. It was gone, and they even had like local neighbors like look at their like Ring doorbells and like scan through the like days of footage to see if they could track it down, but there are no leads. It's just up and vanished.
That's crazy.
And the hope is that this is like totally innocuous, like someone just thought it was like someone putting something out, like the way it's like sits next to the street, so if like some random passerby, like maybe it was like the trash night or something and there was like other people had like furniture out, so it was an honest mistake where they thought someone was just throwing out. And you know, because that makes sense to me, like they're like, why would someone throw out a perfectly good dinosaur and then they picked it up themselves? But I mean, yeah, it's been a while at this point. It's been the better part of a month. And
damn.
Like, we're just hoping that we can get this return. There's some interesting takes from people in the immediate area on the dinosaur's disappearance. Someone on Facebook said, "Hopefully someone is taking it on a global adventure and you'll start getting photos of Dino at the pyramids, the Taj Mahal, Machu Picchu, etc. Then he'll be returned tired and happy to have traveled the globe." To me, that feels highly optimistic. Especially like having to take a 5x3 foot dinosaur through the oversized baggage while boarding a flight does seem like too great of a hurdle to really know, make this possible. But I mean, I like the optimism.
I just looked at the picture. He's really cute.
It is a cute dinosaur, and I would understand the feeling of loss that must accompany. Like, people were saying that this was like a good landmark for where they have their walks. People would like take their daily walk like to the dinosaur and back.
It's just devastating for the local community, for sure.
It is. Another resident said the whole town knows that dinosaur.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's hopefully they're gonna figure this out, and it might just be someone that isn't from the state who's there for whatever reason and picked it up. But as always, the concern is, what if this was rambunctious teens?
That is always the concern.
Like, the second time I've said this episode. I did also find a Reddit thread. This is in the Vermont subreddit, where someone posted the news story about this, and someone in the comments said, time to go undercover in the local high schools. And then the OP responded with, "That's how you get put on a government list." I was tickled by that.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. I haven't seen anywhere whether it has a name or anything. The owners put up some pizza boxes on the street that just say, "T-Rex gone. We are sad." Frowny face. So clearly this has rocked the lives of many.
Yeah.
I guess it's the T-Rex is the most of a name that it has. Yeah, if anyone sees anything, this will have to be something we revisit, and maybe we can start brainstorming how to return some sort of dinosaur to the area. Because, I mean, the local archaeologists are being deprived. But yeah, what else you got, Sarah?
So my second news story is from Maine. And it is about a house that's for sale, which I think that I've now done like multiple articles about houses that are for sale.
Yeah, this is the local real estate portion. This is actually the second part of the local real estate portion.
Yeah. So on the other end of the spectrum of the Conjuring house being $1.5 million, this house is $139,000, which is like
a deal.
Extremely cheap for the current market. And it was the former home of a Maine sea captain who challenged Houdini.
Okay.
So the guy who owned it's name was Captain Elliot C. Gardner.
Oh.
Spelled like your last name,
Old
Connor, which is
Uncle
why
Elliot.
Which is why I really wanted to do this article. It was built in 1820. It's a house with 2 bathrooms, 3 bedrooms, over 3,000 square feet. Basically, the guy was a captain of a boat, a ship of some sort, that through historic records, they were able to say was like the largest ship of its kind in when it came out and like all of these things.
I just found the portion of the article on the boat. It's the largest 4-masted schooner ever built.
Yeah, so he was just a captain of that ship and built this house to live in and die in eventually in early 1900s. He died in 1927, and this was his house, and it's for sale. You could buy it for $139,000. And it doesn't look like that bad. I mean, it's definitely not livable.
It needs some work.
In its current state.
I'm looking at the listing myself. It needs a little bit of work, but the location seems nice. There's some sort of body of water.
The location does seem nice. I'm curious if like anyone has been living in it for the last like 100 years.
It doesn't look like someone necessarily has.
Yeah, which is really interesting to me.
Original.
Because there's no, like, it says that he died in 1927. And then that's it. There's no other information about who owned the house before. Maybe, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, so somehow, that's kind of weird.
Somehow we lost track of like my family being the heirs to the
Pembroke. You should show up and demand the property from them.
This was Uncle Elliot's place. So this is in Pembroke, Maine, which is like this is actually kind of the easternmost section of the U.S. in general. Like this is Pembroke isn't far from the easternmost point of the U.S.
Got it.
I've never been to the area. It's
me neither. But yeah, this house, actually, the further I look, it does look pretty bad on the inside. The outside looks pretty good, though.
Yeah.
Like it looks like, I mean, it's held up.
I think part of the price is just that this is like this is a pretty remote area.
Right.
And this is definitely a home that needs a bunch of work. It's about like
a lot of work.
It's probably an hour out of Bangor. I don't know. I could be convinced. Okay, wait.
Yeah,
wait.
So
wait, we're completely missing the point. How did he challenge Houdini?
Oh, right. I totally forgot.
We're getting way off track.
Okay, so there's like points where he kind of goes off the grid in terms of like historical newspapers and stuff. And so it says he shows up in Maine newspapers again in 1907. In January of that year, he and two other captains issued a joint challenge to the then famous escape artist Harry Houdini. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I'm reading this and I'm just like, oh my God, I'm on the edge of my seat. Like, what happened? Basically, they wanted Houdini to let them sew him into a canvas bag and see if he could get out without ripping the stitches, because they were like, yeah, we're sailors. We know how to tie knots really well. And there's apparently no record of Houdini responding to them.
Wow.
So, yeah. So I was like kind of underwhelming.
Request
I was like, oh.
That fell on deaf ears.
Yeah. I just thought it was funny that that this article was like, he challenged Houdini. And it's like, yeah, he did, but not really. You know, he probably wrote him a letter.
Just wrote him a letter with a couple of friends because he was convinced only like soft sailors were tying the knots.
Yeah, they were just like drunk on a Friday night. And they're like, dude, we should totally challenge him. Like, he would never beat us. Like, we'll know. So yeah, that you can go buy that house and live in an extremely remote part of Maine that probably has like really harsh winters.
If you've got a couple years to spend fixing up a half dilapidated home, then this is
perfect for you.
This could be an option.
It did get posted on like some of those like popular like cheap house pages.
Yeah.
So it probably will get bought by one of those people.
If you imagine it fixed up, it's beautiful.
Oh, totally.
It's got some like fantastic like era appropriate woodwork on the exterior, and I'm sure it's like a lovely area, but
sure,
it's definitely it's gonna take some grit some elbow grease to get it back,
and a lot of money probably.
Well, you know, the initial cost isn't so bad.
No, it's like pretty cheap, like I said, for right now, anyway.
Let's hope that the right person ends up in there and they don't start getting... We're going to check in and 2 years later, this person who's like, yeah, I'm going to like fix it up nice. They're going to be like, yeah, the ghosts in my walls are like telling me to write.
Captain...
He's like writing strongly worded letters to Chris Angel.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say.
You listen like, up, you stupid motherfucker.
The ghost of Captain Elliot is telling me to do this. Oh my gosh.
Beautiful. All right. So that's all we have for the news for today. So let's go over to the TNT hotline and talk to our friend 1 Pound.
You are now on the New Englanders hotline.
Thanks, Luke, for coming on, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
For everyone out there, we all three went to college together at UHeart, and that is how we know each other. And we are very grateful that Luke has graced us with his presence today.
I'm thankful to be on this and catch up with you guys, talk about some stuff.
We could start by just asking, Luke, could you just like introduce yourself and maybe some of like who you are, what you do, where you are nowadays?
Yeah, no problem. My name's Luke, but I go under the artist name 1 Pound. I'm located in Portland, Maine. Grew up in Maine. And I do electronic music. Kind of spans anywhere from like hip hop to IDM, footwork, fusion of all sorts of styles, ambient, new age, whatever it is. Kind of no genre untouched a lot of the times. Yeah, like that's a good summary.
Beautiful. I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I actually do have a question related specifically to the genre, and it's just, have you ever heard of the title Wonky before?
I have, with like LA beat scene stuff.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Yeah, like Sam I Am. Like, I feel like some people call that stuff wonky.
For
and
sure.
Like old like Devin Who stuff, maybe. Yeah, I've heard of that. I feel like that it's been kind of, it's, no one really uses that anymore, but I definitely am inspired by things that have been labeled as wonky.
Yeah, I was kind of curious, like, your overlap with it, because I do hear it, like, it kind of fits a lot of people, but I'd say, like, two of the biggest artists that I know that kind of fit under it are, like, Hudson Mohawk and then Flying Lotus. Yeah. And I know that Flying Lotus is probably in, like, your kind of list of influences, so I didn't know, like, how much you might consider yourself to kind of falling into it.
Yeah, I mean, both of those artists are, like, huge for me. And honestly, in particular, like Hudmo, I found Hudmo in like high school, early on in high school, because of like the Captain Murphy stuff was floating around that Flylo was doing. And I wasn't even really hip on Flylo yet, but I was hip on Captain Murphy. So I didn't even really know it was Flylo at the time, but Hudmo like came on my radar at that time.
Right.
And I fell in love with that style for sure. And he has some really sick boiler rooms from back in the day that I all the time.
Have you heard much of, like, he put out some albums, I think, right around 2020, but they were, like, he put out, I think, 3 records that were, he found old hard drives of his and then sort of finished that music.
Was that the stuff he released recently that was, like, old? Or let me look it up.
Yeah, they all have, like, a bunch of strong guys on the cover.
Is it on his like Bandcamp?
Yeah, it's the 3 albums, BBHE, I guess I have to say this, Poom Gems, and then Airborne Lard.
Honestly, definitely listen to him at some point. Oh yeah. No, yeah, for sure. Those ones, yeah, I love those projects. Yeah, the art is crazy.
Oh my god, I'm looking at it now.
Like, visual language is bizarre. It's like,
yeah,
genuinely insane.
Well, the first vinyl that I ever purchased was a Tonight record, which is Hudson Mohawk and Lunas.
Yeah,
that was like my fucking shit back in the day, and that was just, I found them through Captain Murphy because he rapped on one of those Tonight beats.
Right.
But
I remember when that first EP came out, it was like earth shattering. Like, I mean, it ended up on like Kanye records, ended up like all over the place.
Yeah, it's crazy. I haven't listened to it in a while. I should spin that later. I still got that record. The Satin Panthers record was huge for me too at the time. Mm-hmm. It's become a meme, but the Thibat song I like loved back in the day. I was like, this is the craziest shit.
For those who don't know, that's the song that had like a viral Reddit thread because someone said it was like, it was like the only song some guy was like making love to
It was like her boyfriend put it on every time they had sex, and it was the only song he would put on.
That's the origin of the meme.
Yeah,
it honestly must have been like a lie. Like, there's no way that that actually happened to someone.
It's like a really weird, like creaky sounding beat.
And like, just to be completely transparent, this like side of music is pretty like I've not ventured very far into the electronic world outside of like probably people that are in my direct circle, like you, Luke, but I know that song from the meme.
Yes.
But I was gonna ask, what you mentioned that you got, you know, that was like a big influence for you when you were younger. You found it when you were younger and it was like huge for you. When did you start really making music? Was it back then or more so like once you got to college and stuff?
Yeah, I think it was around like 2012. I started like messing around with music. I wasn't like making it on like a serious level, but I used to edit Call of Duty montages, and I got into the world royalty free music. And then it slowly ventured into like underground electronic music, like independent underground electronic music.
Yeah.
And I started doing vocal like weird loops on Sony Vegas, which is like a video editing software. So I started like chopping stuff on a video editing software initially. And then moved into FL Studio like soon after that, because I realized it not a good place to make music, but around like 2012 2013.
And just curious, the videos you were making, were they like your gameplay in like Call of Duty?
Sometimes it would be for other people. I would edit for like friends or whatever. Like, I don't know, I tried to like get onto a bunch of like editing channels. Like, they would like edit for different teams or whatever to do like weekly montages or whatever. So I never really got onto a team. There was like, I don't know, but mostly my clips.
Nice.
Very nerdy.
Incredible.
Love it.
So I've got a little bit of a segue now to another of my questions. You're talking about like video editing. I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about like the 1 pound visual language, because I feel like you have a very distinct like sense of visuals across your like social media videos, across like your album art, and then your music videos. And I was hoping maybe you could just like tell us a little bit about that, maybe some of your inspirations there.
Yeah. Like I just mentioned, I mean, editing video is kind of like my first relationship with like creativity and art. So I feel like I'd stopped editing video for a really long time. And it wasn't until like 2020 that I started editing again and like shooting video. But it's, I do it in the same way that I kind of make music and run and gun, like just take videos of stuff that it is inspiring to me in that moment. Maybe I'll have something like in mind if I'm like making a beat. I'm like, oh, like it's kind of would look cool with that. Like it's emotive in that way. Maybe I'll capture a satellite from far away or something like that. I don't know. Sometimes it comes with like, a little bit more direction, like the big video I did, the lever video for Revo. That was like that like 4 minute long thing. That one I had like actual shoot days where I was like, communicating with people like, we're gonna meet here at this time, and like I had like more thorough ideas of the direction and stuff. But it's not, I don't know how like actual people do music videos, but it was definitely more of like, okay, I just want this scene. Like, is it in the beginning or is it at the end? Or like, what context is this scene going to be in? No idea. Like, it all, like, the, I was just gathering footage and then like editing it as it went. Yeah. No real plan, just more motifs and kind of puzzling a story together as the editing goes on, rather than, you know, having a grandiose plan, like letting, like, oh, I picked this clip first, I guess that's the that's the intro or yeah, whatever.
Yeah. Kind of letting it like guide you.
Yeah. And for the album art, a lot of the art that I use for album art on like SoundCloud in particular, and it spills off into like, you know, my more official releases on like Spotify and Bandcamp and stuff, is derived from a folder of digital scans of my grandfather's like film collection. Like, wow. He took a bunch of pictures throughout his life. Traveling around the world doing ceramics work, and like geology stuff. Like, so he just like had a really nice camera and ended up getting it scanned really nice. So it's a pretty big folder, and I'll go into it every so often and just like find stuff that catches my eye, and I'll zoom into a little corner of it, because it's such a high resolution scan that it's like, I'll just take like, you know, the smallest little corner of some like building in the background of a photo, whatever location it is, and I'll find inspiration from it and use it as art. And it's nice, because it, a lot of the times it's like, you know, pretty telephoto, and I like that energy, but oftentimes it's not. I mean, it's, you know, it just like the like video editing stuff, the album art is very like, I don't know, find something, and then the gut instinct is usually like the best one.
Yeah. Right. Like it speaks to you.
Yeah.
Rather than you being like, okay, this is what I'm going to create for this.
Right. I'll just have the album on, or maybe not even be listening to the album, or like maybe the art first. Like, I don't know. I constantly am kind of digging in that folder and just kind of like finding new stuff. I mean, I've seen all the photos and I've gone through it, but, you know, combing through them again, I'm always like, oh, that's a cool top right little thing.
Yeah. Or like, you know, something can always speak to you differently at a different time too. So
totally. Yeah. Totally. The high quality, like digital scan is like super useful, because it's like, even though it's so zoomed in, it's like the grains are high definition. Mm. Like it doesn't lose any fidelity when you zoom in, because it's just like, grains. I don't know, it's really cool. But then some of the other art, it's like the last project, Shift Block, that I just put out, my brother took that photo, and my brother has helped me out on other projects with album art, for the self-titled record I did with Minaret. We did like an AI generated like image of my face. We took like hundreds of thousands of photos of my face, and he like put, I mean, he really brought this project. He like set up like this camera thing, a camera computer. They would just take like a photo every like half second or something like that. I don't know. Maybe it was longer, but it was just like a little, like, what are they called? Raspberry Pi, with like a hard drive attached to it, and just like a camera lens thing. Like, it wasn't even a camera, it was just like a computer. It's really interesting. Mm-hmm. And then he used StyleGAN, which is like an AI image processing tool, open source tool. That was a whole thing, like deciding on which photo to use, because it would generate like infinite photos. So it was like, oh shit, we had to really pick. Mostly, I mean, I would say, to summarize, a lot of the time it's not a lot of prep. It's just like whatever the gut feeling is for like the visual display.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Especially with your recent video for Lever. But also, I feel like this is present in your album artwork. This kind of ties it back to the pod and the theme. But I do find that like a lot of the time you're using imagery that is like very evocative of New England, but like Maine and the Maine coast specifically, which I know is like your home, But it's always like, I find it so like cool the way that's expressed through a lot of your visual stuff.
Thank you. Yeah. I love Maine. I feel like it's easy to express that when you got a video camera, you know.
Yeah,
it's just, man. you walk outside and it's like, oh wow, that tree. Dang.
Exactly.
Yeah, I love that video though. Honestly, I like to look back on it. I mean, it's like, also those are like all my friends up here. So it's, you know, it's like moments in time. We're just like hanging out wherever, and I can just like look back on that video.
Yeah.
Be like, oh, a lot of good hangs. And
you're capturing like what, I mean, that time and music for you, but also like that time of life too. I feel like,
yeah.
I think about that a lot with like music videos of any of my friends' work. You know what I mean? It's just like kind of a snapshot of that time of their career, but also of like our lives as a whole. Going off of Connor's little like pointer at, you know, this is a podcast about New England. We talked about your influences and your early influences. Do you have any specifically from New England that you can shout out that you know of?
Like stuff when I was younger?
Or no, even like now.
Anyone.
Yeah. I mean, anyone who influences you artistically. Yeah.
Yeah. There's this guitarist named Lenny Bro from Maine that I've been kind of obsessed with. Recently he passed away in like the 80s, I believe. But just a phenomenal jazz guitarist, and kind of his whole like body of work and just his style and his like craft is like out of this world. The way he played the guitar is like so cool to me, and I think to a lot of people. But just a real master of his craft. And I love thinking about back that he's from Maine. Cause just like some, I mean, like he's well known in certain circles, but pretty underground, guy.
I just looked him up and he looks so cool.
Yeah. You would love the way he plays. I mean, it's like, he would just, it's like his influences. Like I think his parents were, country bluegrass musicians from like Canada, I believe, and they were like pretty popular in Canada. He kind of grew up on like bluegrass stuff, and when he was young he was playing on like bluegrass records like recorded in Maine, and then he kind of studied like flamenco guitar, and then got obsessed with like Bill Evans and was obsessed with how Bill Evans played, and he kind of modeled his playing after Bill a little bit. And it's like, you know, can play a lot more notes at the same time and on a piano and like more complicated rhythmic stuff. And he was like applying a lot of those techniques to guitar with like, you know, harmonics and different like finger techniques. And I don't know, I get inspired by that because it's just like, oh, he loved like a certain sound, and he had his own instrument and had to kind of like work with the limitations to like get that sound. I don't know. That's someone who comes to mind kind of immediately. Love Lenny Bro. A lot of lore behind him too. He's a fascinating like internet read. I'm trying to think of like modern people. I mean, all of like the Resample crew in Maine, I love a lot. The beat scene up here is really interesting. I love Pink Navel. Shout out Dev.
Shout out.
Yes.
While we're on the topic, I'd love to ask you more about Resample. And we were just speaking about like visuals and everything. And some of my favorite media of yours are your live performances with Resample, which have these just like really cool analog like visuals overlaid. And it just like looks like the most amazing sort of scene.
Yes. Dave is the mastermind. He goes by the artist name Fiverr, F-Y-V-R. He also makes beats. He doesn't right now, but he will again at some point. He bugged him to do it. He makes good-ass beats. But yeah, he's like an amazing visual artist. I'll send you guys a picture of like his rig, but of like the last show. I mean, every show for the last, like, I don't know how long we've been doing, like 7 years, he's like leveled up every single time, but basically has just an array of CRT TVs that are getting different signals, and he, you know, he acquires odd VHS tapes and odd, like, old public broadcast network, like, video mixing devices, and like some of them are like kind of like broken, maybe, I don't know. I mean, like, it's a crazy thing, and his whole rig is just like honestly beyond my knowledge of that stuff. He's also an electrician, and so he has like a lot of that like electrical background, and I feel like I can understand that stuff a little bit more thoroughly than a lot of people.
Hell yeah. For those who are listening who don't know, could you kind of explain what Resample is?
Resample is it's changed over the years, but it's a night that, not to compare directly to this, but it's kind of like a low end theory inspired electronic music beat night thing. There's a core group of us, like residents, for lack of a better term, that play the shows and kind of organize the shows, and we'll bring up people that we think are really cool to play a show, and sometimes people rap, sometimes people will DJ, sometimes people will, you know, do whatever on stage. I mean, it's just a night of electronic music and beat music. We've been doing it, I started getting involved in like 2017. I think that's kind of like when it was gathering its footing, maybe like 2018, I don't know. When did that show we did at Dennis with like Liz and Foyzy and U4? Do you guys remember that show?
Yeah. Hold on, let me look.
It was after that.
When was that?
It's probably on the WSAM page. Hold on.
Oh, it was December 2nd, 2017. Yeah.
Yeah. Sick. The sweet poster. Yeah, so it was around then that, because Foyzy told me about, because I was talking to Foyzy at that show, and he was saying that, or I was telling him, I was like, oh, I'm from Maine. Like, I feel like there's like no one kind of in the scene up there. And he was like, no, there's this dude, Turquoise Crown, who makes insane music. And he's from Portland. And so I hit up Turquoise Crown, and it was around that time that him and Fiverr were like already talking about doing shows, or had already started doing shows or something like that. So they were like, oh, totally hop on some bills. And that's when like the beat night was becoming more of a consistent thing. And then it eventually got the name Resample. Currently it consists of Turquoise Crown, Bruv, Bizza, Fiverr, and myself. Those are the active artists. I could be forgetting someone, which would be bad. Forgive me if I have. But it's, you know, people come and go with the scene. Before COVID too, like, we were doing them pretty much like bi-monthly or every other month. And after COVID, a lot, like Dave Fiverr, he moved away. Like, he's like an hour and a half north. And I don't know, it was like hard to kind of like get the energy back. And so now we're kind of doing it annually, or sometimes a little bit more frequent than that. But
yeah.
I feel like, I mean, every scene was pretty like impacted by COVID in like different ways. So like, for sure, I know like in Connecticut, basically every DIY space like closed. And yeah, I feel like just now things are like kind of starting to like get a little bit more normal, but there's still like hardly anything, you know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You can definitely feel it clawing its way back.
Totally.
Yeah. I mean, otherwise, besides like the Resample stuff, what is the music scene like in Portland, like for you or in general? Like, what do you think of it?
It's really cool. You know, there's a lot of really talented musicians that are just walking around everywhere. And there's a lot of like hardcore shows, which are cool. It's not really like my genre, but big hardcore scene up here.
Yeah.
The jazz scene is really cool. I work at a jazz club doing live sound, and there's a really healthy jazz scene, which is honestly, I think, really awesome.
I mean, yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, there's like a monthly jazz or a weekly jazz jam, and it's just, it gets completely filled up with musicians just trying to push their way onto the stage. It's, everyone's really good, and a lot of people, you know, it's like their first time at a jazz jam, and it's like everyone's really supportive, but there's like some straight, like, real talents on stage with someone who's like just getting started, and it's cool to watch. It's cool to watch.
Yeah.
But the DJ scene's also really good. There's a bunch of really talented DJs in town. And there's like a whole like party scene kind of developing with like more, you know, geared toward like techno music and that kind of underground electronic dance music stuff.
I feel like I'm seeing that like kind of show up even here, like in Connecticut now too. Like, I feel like it's kind of showing up around more.
It's really fun, honestly. I've been playing some of those shows where, you know, I'm not necessarily playing my music. Just kind of, you know, having fun spinning other tracks and getting to share like, you know, the stuff I'm listening to. And yeah, it's sick. There's this dude, Chris Gilman, who is a killer light designer, who's been making a lot of these parties activate like crazy atmosphere. I don't know. It's the whole scene is kind of like stepping up right now in that regard. And it's really fun. A lot of underground shows. It's cool.
I would love to maybe segue to talking a little about your most recent release, Shift Lock, which came out September 20th. And I saw on the credits for the album that a big catalyst for how you were working on it was incorporating a new tool into your tool set, and that's a software called Dispatch. And I was hoping that you could describe how using Dispatch influenced the record and maybe just like your workflow in general.
Yeah. So my good friend Anthony Ark, he goes by the artist name Ark and a few other artist names. He put me on to this plugin. It's like a Max Fly plugin designed by John House, and it's a modulation matrix thing. Basically like a bunch of oscillators that interact with each other in odd ways, that kind of creates its own clock a little bit. It creates crazy rhythms, and over a long period of time, so you'll get like a one after like, you know, 38 beats. It's like 1/38 or some crazy shit like that. But it's not too off kilter for you to not find a groove. Like, it oddly, you can like sync it, you can like quantize it. So there's like modes where it'll be completely on its own, you know, clicking away at whatever you set the oscillators to, and they can go down to like, you know, LFO range all the way up until, I think it goes sonic, like, you know, past human hearing.
Sure.
But I don't know, it allows for like a different textural landscape to, you know, trigger percussion or kick drums or noise samples. And it really freed me up in a way that I haven't really felt in a while. Cause it just, you know, I love like artists like Anu, also known as Cake Dog, who kind of like operates crazy rhythmic percussion music and like footwork music with like really detailed rhythms. And this kind of is reminiscent of those wild rhythms, but I don't know. It's so familiar yet so distant. Like, when I listen to it, I like love listening to it, cause I almost feel like, I mean, I programmed it, right? But you know, to get to some of the rhythms, it was, you know, the program told me what they were.
Yeah.
So I kind of, you know, I gave up on the sense of control, and you know, it's cool, cause you can operate it in a quantized landscape or an unquantized landscape. I think most of the tunes on that project were operating quantized, except for the second to last track. That was, I'm pretty sure, totally like unquantized, just kind of letting Dispatch run amok, triggering these different samples and resonators to make chords. And I don't know, it just kind of allowed me to paint with the sound rather than make a song. And then I could use my like song techniques on top of that with a lot of those tunes. So maybe it'll like the chord, maybe I'll have like a chord stab on like a one and it's in 4/4, but I have these crazy percussions or textures kind of whipping around and operating in like delayed network and, you know, triggering at different points on like the sample in the sampler, like start like changing up the start point relative to like whatever dispatch wants it to do. Like, yeah, but it's so like it's so not in a groove, but it's so is like your brain kind of recognizes when the one comes back a little bit in some of those rhythms. Like it becomes like a familiar sense of like, you know, there's a really good video that John posted, like kind of like a tutorial on dispatch. And in the tutorial, he talks about like generative music, because it's close to like a generative piece of software, but it's not, because it's cyclical. There's a point where like the rhythms, because they're all interacting, all these oscillators that are triggering samples, they're like they come back together. But he talks about it like kind of not hating on generative music, but liking aspects of generative music. And this is his like version of generative music in a weird way. Maybe I'm interpreting it wrong, but it's, you have control. Like it gives the artist control of the chaos. I don't know. I feel like I kind of rambled on there for a sec.
No,
it's great. I love the software. I use it on everything now. So say I'll have, you know, some standard tune that has, you know, maybe like a dub techno track or something like that. Mm-hmm. I'll throw a dispatch thing in there and just use it for one track and just have it like trigger some vocal samples. And it just creates insane rhythms. And it's, you know, it's so easy to groove to, but it's like, what the fuck is it? Like if you were to count it out, you could find it. You could like, you know, write down like whatever the time signatures or whatever like the rhythm is, but it's, I don't know, it's more fun to just let it be and just be like, ah, that's nice.
So it kind of lets you operate on kind of like a polyrhythmic sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Very cool. I've got to say that I'm really excited about this release, especially because to me, as far as like your discography, this might be sort of the glitchiest I've heard you, as far as It does feel like one of your most experimental releases so far, and I've really enjoyed it.
Hey, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I was nervous putting it out a little bit, just because definitely is experimental, but it's gotten good feedback, so I'm excited that people are digging it. Feels really true to me, too.
Hell yeah. Well, I also loved it, so... I wanted to chime in there.
Thank you.
Connor knows so much more about electronic music and the technical side of things than I do. I'm very interested in all of it, but I'm like also like, I don't know half the words you're saying right now, which makes me sound like a dumb idiot. But
I'm very interested in it. To be honest, I don't even know how that software really works. I just kind of like turn the knobs and then it
play
like
around with it
thing. Yeah, it's like, oh, that sounds good. Use it.
Hell yeah. Connor, did you have any other questions, or was that,
you know, I have a really stupid question.
Ooh, hit me.
All right, so 1 pound, is the pound a unit of weight, or like a dollar? like a euro?
Well, the origin of the name comes from my initials, which is LB, like a pound. And I played soccer in high school, and I had like my initials on like a piece of like practice gear, and someone on the team would call me Pounds, and then it eventually like shifted to 1 pound. And I was like making music at that time, and I was like, I don't know what the fuck to call myself. And that was like the only nickname I had ever received. And it was by one guy. And I wanted to use like 1 pound, like the number, but it wouldn't, that shit's not going to come up in Google searches. So I just switched it to one, like you won a game.
Wow.
One.
Hell yeah. I remember you telling me that backstory like one night after we were like doing something in WSAM and we were hanging out and you were wearing like a pair of like sweatpants that had LB on them. And I think I remember being like, or pointing it out or something. And then you explained that whole story to me.
Yeah, those are the pants.
Hell yeah.
So I'm taking this as an answer of it's a unit of weight.
Yes, absolutely a unit of weight. And I think I have surpassed the Google search of, if, because before when you would search 1 pound before, like, you know, I had internet presence, it was like the Korean one to British pound like conversion calculator.
That still comes up.
It still comes up. Fuck.
It's like my algorithm. It's like the fifth or sixth result though.
Oh, okay.
But it's like, yeah, convert Korean, South Korean one to British pounds is number five. All of your stuff is at the top though.
Yeah, when I look it up, you've got like a little like an icon, like it's your picture from your self-titled record.
Oh, so I have beaten it.
Yeah. But
no,
again,
okay, good.
Sarah and I's algorithm is going to be skewed by listening to your music.
Right.
No, you have that on mine as well. I'm just saying the like fifth result down when you scroll.
There it is.
Yeah, I see it.
We'll keep pushing it down.
Yeah. Right.
I also have one parting question for you. That is, what is your favorite thing about Maine?
Oh, my favorite thing about Maine. Oh man, my gut reaction is just like my family. Family's here.
Oh,
love my family. Yeah.
Shout out.
But yeah. Regardless of the, maybe if we're gonna take it to like, you know, the state, I like the cold wind at the end of September. I like that feeling.
Mm.
It's like a cold wind at the end of the day. It's nice.
Hell yeah. Awesome. We always ask that question, I feel like, to our guests of what is their favorite thing about New England or about their state. And I feel like I never know what to expect. And there's always a really good answer. And that is a really good answer.
Sweet.
I actually did have one more question for you. Am I misremembering, or for a while, did you work on a lobster boat?
Worked in a lobster pound. It's like the place where the lobsters go after the boat.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Take it off like a truck and put him, weigh him out and put him into different tanks of like different weights, like small lobsters to like the bigger lobsters. Yeah, that was like my first job. But yeah, I used to like pick lobster too. Just like, it sounds like picking it out of the water, but it's like when you, it's how you get like the meat out. It's like you do like a bunch of cooked lobster, and then you pull all the meat out and put it into like different little containers, like different weights or whatever, to like for people to buy.
That is such a like inherently Maine.
That's why I had to ask.
Job.
Yeah, good question.
And also, you being a expert on weights are perfectly suited.
Right. Nice.
I just occurred to me because I feel like one of my like last memories about just like graduating UHeart was also like we went to that, they have this like steak and lobster dinner, and I just remember so vividly you kind of like looking at the lobsters that we were given and we're like, man, these are like gross.
Oh really?
I just remember them like, it was kind of like, I don't know. The quality of food at that event was not the highest. At least not the way I remember.
I believe that. That's funny.
Damn, we didn't even get that.
What event was that?
It was the graduating steak and lobster dinner. It was like,
I don't even, that's so funny. I don't remember that.
Like, was it like senior week or whatever?
Yeah,
the
it's
hell
like the
did?
Senior week like kickoff, honestly.
Okay.
Before we like went to the casino or whatever the fuck that was.
Exactly, exactly. I just remember thinking that I should trust your opinion because you're an expert.
Yeah. Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, that scale, that many people, it's like that shit's been
also like at UHeart.
Wow. Yeah. Shit is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Honestly, so funny. Damn, GSU. What was that bagel spot? I used to hit that bagel spot all the time.
GSU.
Einstein's. We don't have that in Maine.
I honestly have no idea where they have those. Like,
I don't even know.
Like an airport.
I don't even know if they exist anywhere else. Oh my god.
Food.
No, that is honestly extremely. I mean, that's kind of all of the chains they had in there. I mean, that was the Moe's, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And then
that Moe's was so clutch.
Dude, I ate Moe's for the first time since like being at UHeart because I feel like I ate so much of it.
Yeah.
There that I like over like I met my quota for like 5 years.
Is it just as okay or good?
Yeah, it was yeah. Fun. I mean, honestly, like yeah. I got a stack and I was like, holy shit, I like forgot how much this like made me survive in college.
Yeah.
You know that Moe's is an acronym?
What?
I'm not lying. It's officially.
What does it stand for?
Musicians, outlaws, and entertainers.
What?
I'm serious.
Why?
Look it up.
What?
It's got like a classic rock theme, but it's musicians, outlaws, and entertainers.
I literally don't believe you. I'm looking it up right now.
I'm dead serious.
Oh my god, you're right. That's insane.
Wait,
that's
what?
Insane.
No,
I wouldn't
lie. I don't.
Why was it called that? There's no explanation. Wikipedia.
What does Moe's stand? Are you kidding? Oh, it's inspired by Grateful Dead fans?
What? Wait,
oh, yeah.
What?
Isn't like Slash, like Loki, the mascot? Like, when you, like, isn't he kind of like in the logo or something?
Dude, that is crazy.
That's crazy. Do they supply, you know how like Taco Bell supplies like musicians on tour with free food? Does Moe's do that too?
No idea.
I feel like they should.
Here, wait. Look.
The name like that.
At the outside of their locations, there's like a little cutout and it looks like Slash. Here, I'll send it to the chat.
Okay.
This is the inevitable Moe's segment about each episode.
Right. Right. There's no Moe's up here. I miss Moe's. I actually don't know if I miss
Moe's.
Yeah,
you're
Moe's,
not really.
But...
You're not missing out.
Yeah.
That.
All right. Look at this image in the Discord chat and tell me.
Oh
that
my god!
Slash.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. That's crazy.
It's the way that it's like very low key a Guns N' Roses restaurant.
Right.
Oh my god. All right. Well, I have to hop off. So.
On that note.
On that note. Thank you again, Luke, for coming on and talking to us about music and about Maine and about Moe's. I very much so appreciate you.
Very appreciated. And everyone listening has to go listen to the record and also your entire discography.
Right now. Right now.
Wow. Thank you guys for having me and thinking of me. And I don't know. This is really fun. It's really fun to talk to you guys too.
Absolutely.
Hell yeah, for sure. Well, farewell.
So au revoir. Sailors into the night.
Welp, that is all we have for you in this episode. If you've made it this far, we are especially thankful for you listening and for sticking around with us. Thank you again to our friend One Pound for hanging out with us. You are all now required to go listen to his work wherever it is that you enjoy your music. We here at TNNE sincerely hope you enjoy the rest of your day, and we'll see you in the next episode. Goodbye.